An Irish-American Catholic by birth and a skeptic by profession, New York Times columnist Timothy Egan set out on a nearly 1,200-mile hike on the historic Via Francigena Trail. As he put it, the mission? To find God in Europe before God is gone. His journey from Canterbury, England, went across France, Switzerland, and Italy, and it influenced what he does and does not believe. It's a deep dive into the history of Europe and the Catholic faith. Tim is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and a best-selling author. He's written 8 books, now his 9th. It's called A Pilgrimage to Eternity, From Canterbury to Rome in Search of Faith. Tim, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Rick.
Wow. A pilgrimage from Canterbury to Rome. The Via Francigena, that means the St. Francis way?
It's the way, yeah, the way through France is what it's sometimes interpreted as.
Is it the same route as Canterbury Tales, the Chaucer book?
No, the start is the same as Canterbury Tales. So Okay. We owe our, you know, so much of our English literature, Canterbury Tales, to the pilgrims who would go to Canterbury and try to outdo each other in tales of derring do to get to this shrine where Thomas Becket was hacked to
death. So that was an example, but this was sort of this medieval approach to pilgrimage.
Exactly.
People would go somewhere, they'd be on a journey.
Exactly. And this, and the Via Francigena, by the way, which is less known than the Camino de Santiago, was the most popular pilgrimage route in the medieval ages. 1 million people a year made that journey. Many of them did not make it back. They died of exposure. There were robbers. There was all this stuff along the way. The reason to go was because if you could make it to Rome, all your sins would be forgiven. Therefore, a pilgrimage to eternity.
So that was like the Camino to Santiago. If you made it to Santiago de Compostela, you had that sort of reward of forgiveness.
Right.
I think Muslims are supposed to, in one time in their lifetime, go do the Hajj to go to Mecca.
Right, exactly.
Same sort of thing, I would imagine. Now, describe the route, because I was fascinated in your book, A Pilgrimage to Eternity. It sounded like it was a bonanza. It was just a parade of history and places wrapped up in the Christian story.
Right. So I'll be honest with you, as a fellow lover of Europe, it's spectacular, Rick. It's some of the most glorious country in the world. If there wasn't even a religious reason to go there, it's worth the walk, because it's every place is a new adventure. Every place is a drama. Every place is a fresh, who are you going to meet now? What are you going to bump into? But then it has the bonus of being the theological cradle of Christianity. So there's not a place where a martyr hasn't been hacked to death, or a king hasn't been crowned with the oil of God, or a miracle hasn't happened, or an army came together. Every place is some extraordinary event. And as a time traveler, which is what I call myself instead of a historian, it's marvelous. It's just spectacular.
Time traveler. You know, I've been dealing with the same thing, because people ask me, why am I so excited about Garibaldi?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I know what it would be like, because of my love of history, to be in an Italian in a peninsula where there was no Italy.
When he's trying to bring Italy together. Exactly. Yeah.
Why are you so excited about Martin Luther? Because I can imagine 500 years ago, the frustration if you wanted to read the Bible and you couldn't because it was only in Latin and they had to dole it out to you on their terms.
It was the clerical filter.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So when you travel, when you see that Gothic cathedral on the horizon, you imagine a pilgrim in the old days without a map, and he saw the spire, and he would set his sights on that spire.
Without a GPS, without a phone, without good footwear, without good nutrition. I mean, I had the best stuff that REI could provide and still got horrible blisters. One of the many cool things about the Via Francigena is that at the end of every day, especially in Italy, you're just beat dead tired after doing your 18 miles. And then there's the glorious hill town. That's your destination for the day.
Oh, yeah.
So you still have 1,000 vertical feet you have to kill. But then you're going to consume 3,000 calories shortly thereafter. So it's a great reward.
That's a great thing about travel.
Yeah.
In your book, you call the Via Francigena, and that's the pilgrimage way from Canterbury in England all the way to Rome in the Vatican, you call it the thinking person's Camino.
Yeah, exactly. So the pilgrims I met along the way had introduced me to this concept that I didn't know, you probably know it, of deep walking.
Mm-hmm.
That in a given day, you're going to try to put aside your digital distractions. You're going to try to resolve some things. Now, some people would say that's naive. I don't think you would say that. But, you know, you try to answer these age-old questions. Some of them have to do with, is there a benevolent God that would allow the Holocaust? You know, a question that theologians have stopped asking, but most of us have not. Some of it has to have to do with, you know, how this church can prevail with a pope I really, really respect and admire, but with so much awful history. And so the thinking man's trail is it prompts these thoughts along the way.
deep walking, a way to meditate while moving.
Exactly.
I think that's what you called it in your book.
Exactly.
Yeah. Maybe there's even an advantage to be moving while you're meditating on this.
Well,
sort of
if you were just sitting around in your room thinking about this, it wouldn't be the same.
No, you're right.
There's a great prompt, Rick. There's all this vast stimulus. And the other thing
is, you're immersed in it. You're swimming through a tide
pool. Exactly. And to think that also, when I was on the final stretch of the VF, which is the Via Antica, the Roman road, to think of my footprints going over the worn rock of, 200 generations of similar pilgrims just gave me shivers.
You know, I crossed that little hill. What is it? Monte Mario?
Yeah.
There's a bluff.
Right.
And I walked over it on the 500th anniversary of the time that Martin Luther did it. He walked from Germany all the way there.
He did.
With lousy shoes.
Exactly.
And he came across that bluff, and there he sees St. Peter's, the Mecca of Christendom.
Right. That's the highest point in Rome, by the way. I think it's 587 feet above sea level. I heard something in Canterbury, Rick, when I started this pilgrimage from an Anglican woman minister. I went to the oldest church in the English-speaking world, St. Martin's, with just a handful of congregants there. But the sermon was remarkable, and she talked about Kairos time versus Chronos time, which is in the Greek New Testament. Kairos is the time we measure our lives by. Minutes, hours, seconds, days, weeks, months. Chronos time, she said, are moments when awe and wonder seem to stand still. When I was in that park at the end of my pilgrimage, 500 feet above Rome, I said to my wife, pause, Kairos time, take it in.
You know, this is kind of related, I think, to what you talk about in your book, Tim, this modern versus medieval mindset. And a medieval mindset can be a bad thing in some cases, but it can also be a very good thing. And a lot of people are so quick to condemn organized religion. It seems to me, sadly, they sort of take it out on God when what they're condemning is what people have done in the name of God. And in a big picture, God's probably just up there chuckling, you know?
Yeah, you raise a fantastic question. And that's one I wrestled with, too, was that I started this pilgrimage as a skeptic because I'm a journalist and, sort of prove it to me. Someone who had every reason to have abandoned my Catholic faith because there was some pain in my own family. How the clerical abuse scandal affected us. But saying to myself, I'm going to strip away the cynicism. I'm going to strip away my skepticism. I'm in my 60s. I'm going to try to have a road to revelation. I don't know what that road is, but I'm going to be open-minded to it. And I came to the roughly, well, I don't want to tell how I ended up, but I'll tell you, one of my conclusions was similar to yours, which was that I don't blame Christ in any way. His philosophy, if you look at it even on gays, he doesn't say a word about gays in the New Testament anywhere. How did this come from? It's how organized religion shaped these thoughts. So I came to a much more appreciative and open view of the supernatural, of miracles, of people who have genuine faith and are trying to do good things. But also I came to a much more negative view of when church and state join.
You know, I was just thinking, a lot of people say have a safe trip. Maybe a dangerous trip is transformative travel, and it gets you away from your comfortable preconceptions and your easy cynicism.
Very good observation, because I said at the start of this book, for those pilgrims of long ago, this was the most dangerous thing they could do in their lives. Not just physically dangerous, but some of them would start out as Christians and end up as atheists. Others would start out as atheists and end up as Christians. For me, it became the same way. I met many atheists on this trail, and many young people too. Because pilgrimage is a way the young do religion in some respects.
You know, we're talking right now with the best-selling author and New York Times columnist Tim Egan. And Tim's written a book called A Pilgrimage to Eternity, From Canterbury to Rome in Search of a Faith. And it shares his introspective time as he ventured, wore out shoes, and suffered through, I would think, horrific medieval blisters on your journey from Canterbury to Rome.
Despite the best boots REI has.
Oh, man. All along the medieval Via Francigena, the Way of St. Francis. We have links to Tim's work with this week's show. It's at ricksteves.com/radio. And to learn more about Tim's work, his website is timothyeganbooks.com. That's E-G-A-N, timothyeganbooks.com. So, Tim, when you talked about setting out to be a pilgrim, you needed to get in physical and spiritual shape. I can imagine what getting in physical shape for a long hike is. Talk about getting in spiritual shape before this journey. This is courageous, and you got to get in shape spiritually for something that could be transformational.
Very observant question, because the physical part is the easier part. It's easy to run stairs and do laps and get my upper thighs in shape and all of that and lose some weight. Most of us can do that.
Right.
So I tried to atone. I tried to make a donation to charity. I tried to cleanse myself of some of my bitterness. But no, it's the process of decluttering. And then the much harder thing is the digital cleanse part of it. And I want to make a point about something you said earlier about the spiritual. I say in the book that we are all spiritual beings, but a curse of modern life is that we suffer from malnutrition of the soul. We don't know how to tend the soul because modern life doesn't allow us many opportunities. I'm not even talking in the specific range of organized religion. I'm just talking about attending it. And that's why I think, Rick, pilgrimages are so popular. 200 million people a year worldwide make some sort of pilgrimage.
You said the Alps were about your favorite part, the Italian Alps, because it's just soaked in the supernatural.
Yeah.
What's an example?
Well, you know this. Every part of Italy, the landscape itself is stitched to mysticism.
Yeah.
You know, there's a saint who died there. There's a miracle that happened here. And this is what I really noticed about the two countries' difference, France and Italy, the two biggest countries in the Via Francigena. The French were fine, but they were a little dismissive. You know, kind of meh. And I even say the French dogs had an attitude, you know.
Yeah.
You get to Italy, and this one of the first things that happens is this woman comes out and kisses me on the cheek. And she says, I'm no longer Catholic, but I love pilgrims. When you get to Rome, you must say ciao to Papa Francesca. Tell him I love Papa Francesca.
I'm no Catholic, but give right. Papa
and she,
Francesca
she gave
my
me this big kiss on the cheek. And the Italians were like that. They were very welcome. They really welcome and respect and love Via Francigena pilgrims.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Tim Egan, and his book is A Pilgrimage to Eternity. From Canterbury to Rome in Search of a Faith. We know Tim from his work as a New York Times columnist and some of his other great novels, and this is his latest, sharing how this was a transformational experience, and it's something that anybody can risk having if they make the point to go on a pilgrimage. Tim, when I think of a pilgrimage, I think of pain. When I think of, you know, devotion, you think of pain, and it can be ugly, people whipping themselves and this kind of thing.
The flagellants.
It can be, I climbed the holy steps in Rome on my knees just to see what it's like. It's
holy
painful.
Cow.
And that's just a small thing, but
right. You've
got Jesus on the cross up at the top of the staircase, and you got all these old devout Catholics around me climbing on the knees and saying the Our Father on every step.
Right.
And I'm on my knees just to try to understand it.
Mm-hmm.
I did. When you've got that pain, you empathize a little more with this.
Did it change your view in any way?
It made me think about suffering and other things. But you had pain on your trip with the drudgery of hiking and dealing with the demands physically.
Well, you know, climate change is affecting Europe rather dramatically. And I started out in May, and I had an incredible heat wave. I don't know if you remember 2 years ago when Europe was ablaze and much of it was on fire. I mean, I had 100-degree temperatures in May. That alone was hard. And then get snowstorms on the other side. I mean, that's part of the adventure, of knowing, you know, one day it's going to be like this, the next day it's going to be like that. Getting lost is part of the adventure. I got lost a bunch of times, and that's really hard. You know, at the end of the day, it's getting dark, and you're just getting ready. You don't know where you're going to stay. I never traveled with a sleeping bag. I had to make it to a monastery, a hostel, or a hotel.
What an adventure. I would love to hear your thought on your experience about relics and miracles, because this is something that modern people have a very tough time, and you can be logical. There's something beyond logic. But you had an experience at Santa Lucia Filippini?
Yes, Filippini. So I started out just totally flabbergasted by the concept of relics. They're basically body parts. A piece of a finger of St. Thomas, a hair clipping from another martyr. And then you get to Italy and you realize a fair amount of the churches have a body underneath the altar there in the crypt. And in the Catholic faith, there's a concept called incorruptibility, which means a person has lived a saintly life and the body does not decay. Well, of course, I was skeptical of this. And then I get to Montefiascone, which has the third largest dome in all of Christendom. The first is in Florence. The second is St. Peter's Square. The third is in the Cathedral of Santa Margherita. I got there on this dark and stormy night near the end of my pilgrimage. I was bone tired. I was wet. And I went and stripped off my clothes. I ran to the church in the howling storm. I ignored the third largest dome in Christendom to go down into the crypt and see San Lucia Filippini through the glass. So I'm all alone, just me and Lucy. And I walk close. I get within 10 feet. And she's lying on her side. She's got this alabaster pale face. She looks like Elizabeth Warren. And then, now I'm a skeptic. Her eyes opened. The eyes, I clearly saw the eyes slowly open. I got out my camera. I took a bunch of pictures. And then the eyes slowly closed. And I later wrote a note to the Bishop of Montefiascone saying, okay, you know, you got a little undertaking trick going on here. You know, the American Girl dolls that my daughter used to have, their eyes opened when you turned them.
So wait a minute. I'm sitting across from Tim Egan, the Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times columnist. You're in a crypt in Italy, and you're looking at some relics, and the eyes literally opened and closed, you saw.
Of a 362-year-old dead woman, again, who looked pretty good. And yeah. Her miracle was her saintly life. She promoted schools right. for girls and stuff like that. It's tough the way you phrased it, but that's what happened. I couldn't shake my skepticism. Now, here's what happened later on. I asked the other pilgrims as I got near the end if anyone had seen this. Well, there was a Russian physicist who was traveling the Via Francigena for penance for his role in Chernobyl. He didn't speak a word of English, but my English friend told me he saw the same thing I did. So I said, great. My only corroborating witness is a man who knows too much and can't speak a word of English.
Oh, man.
But Rick, honestly, I know what happened. I hadn't had a drink. You know, I'm fully aware of my senses and this and that. I saw this. I saw these eyes open.
Tim, I loved it when you walked into Rome thinking what it would be like to walk in Rome as a pilgrim, and you did it. And you stood before that statue of Bruno on Campo di Fiore, and you looked into Bruno's eyes. What did you think? What was that like?
Well, Bruno was the heretic who was burned for believing what every third grader today knows to be true, simple science. The interesting thing, he's staring across with his cowl at the Vatican less than a mile away. Now that history turns and pivots, now we have a pope, Pope Francis, who embraces science, who spoke to the American Congress and said, don't be in climate denial, but don't deny science, who had Stephen Hawking come visit him and loved talking to him and hearing about it. And he said that every new thing we learn from science is evidence of the divine. So, but it was interesting because...
And the Bruno statue is right there in a square today that celebrates hedonism and secularism.
Right, right. And, and beneath, I think that at the base of the statue, it says, to Bruno from the people he foresaw.
Oh, yeah. See, yeah. The people he foresaw is actually the Pope today.
Exactly right. That's the point I make, the great
irony.
The
Pope today, who's celebrated a square, a piazza in Rome being named after Martin Luther.
Exactly.
Things change.
Yeah, he really reached out to Lutherans, too.
Yeah. So this is an ongoing thing, and to be travelers, mm-hmm. we can be open to that. To be a tourist is to have a bucket list and take a selfie. To be a traveler is to go to learn about a place and broaden your perspective. To be a pilgrim is to learn not necessarily about the place, but about yourself. It can be transformational. And your book is a testimony to that. I love this notion that you talked about in your book. There is no way. The way is made by walking.
It's from Saint Labre, the patron saint of the homeless. He was a wanderer all his life, and he died in the Colosseum with scabs and wounds all over him at the age of 37. He lived in France, and he still lives on. There's a big celebration in his name, but he spent his entire life with other homeless people wandering around Europe. And that wonderful line I found early on in the pilgrimage, it became one of my themes, that there is no way, the way is made by walking. And it's sort of a universal sentiment. If you take that to heart and you're open, I think a lot of things will happen to you.
Tim Egan, thank you so much for the courage and the openness and the spirit of exploration to take a pilgrimage from Canterbury to Rome and then write about it.
Thank you, Rick.
Thank you. Timothy Egan is the author of A Pilgrimage to Eternity, From Canterbury to Rome in Search of a Faith. His latest work just came out. It's Fever in the Heartland, and that's a historical thriller about an early 20th century plot by the Indiana KKK to take over America. We'll take a closer look at the role of religious relics next on Travel with Rick Steves.